Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about butterfly trafficking with Jessica Spiert, author of Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler. Winged Obsession is a story about Yoshi Kojima, the world's most wanted butterfly smuggler, and the rookie U.S. Fish and Wildlife agent, Ed Newcomer, who finally brings him down. The trade in rare butterfly species is a lucrative business. While there is much trade that is legal, the illegal butterfly trade could be worth up to $200 million a year. Habitat loss is the most significant threat to butterflies, but poaching adds to the stress on these delicate insects, so much so that when criminals target the rare species, extinction becomes a real possibility. As Jessica describes in her book, Winged Obsession, poachers pursue many of the most endangered species. Often, poachers prowl national parks pretending they're amateur enthusiasts. Then they collect butterfly eggs, which they can raise in a controlled environment. They do this because traders want perfect specimens. If there's any damage to the wings, the value of the butterfly drops dramatically. As Spiert describes in this interview, the way you get a perfect specimen is to kill them shortly after they're born. There's no other way to make sure its wings remain unused and in perfect condition. People love butterflies. For many, they're symbols of the process of transformation, of life and death, of beauty and hope. For the ecosystem, they play important roles as a primary food source for other animals, as pollinators, and as caterpillars in cycling nutrients through the system by chewing and digesting leaves. In Japan, bugs are a national obsession, Spiert says, explaining how butterfly smuggler Kojima got into the field. Nowhere is the passion for insects greater than in Asia, and Japan is the Mecca, she says. In fact, one of every 10 Japanese men is considered to be an obsessive butterfly collector. To the Japanese, beauty and harmony are to be found in natural things. Butterfly collectors with the financial means will do whatever necessary to obtain the specimens they want, she says. For some, it's like stamp collecting. For others, it's the equivalent of collecting a Renoir or a Van Gogh. The smuggler in Spiert's book, Winged Obsession, was an expert. Yoshi Kojima had received his university degree in entomology and learned all about the business from his father, who was a well-known butterfly collector. He commanded a network of poachers around the globe who would collect for him, on his orders, the rarest of species, including what's considered to be the Big Four. The Big Four includes the Queen Alexandra's birdwing from Papua New Guinea, which is the largest butterfly with a wingspan of 10 inches and a sales price of between $8,500 to $10,000 a pair. It also includes the giant swallowtail that lives only in Jamaica, the Luzon peacock swallowtail from the Philippines, and the Corsican swallowtail, which is endemic to Sardinia and Corsica and sells for between $800 to $1,000 each. All four are endangered and listed on Appendix 1 of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, also known as CITES. That means that international commercial trade in these species is banned. But probably because it is illegal to catch, kill, or import them, that makes collectors want them all the more. And, as Winged Obsession details, smuggler Kojima always found a way. Jessica Spiert is a freelance journalist specializing in wildlife enforcement issues. She's been published in the New York Times Magazine, Omni, Travel and Leisure, Audubon, National Wildlife, Mother Jones, Delta Sky Magazine, and many others. She's also the author of 10 crime novels featuring the fictional character of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent Rachel Porter. Rachel has an unwavering devotion to tracking down the enemies of rare and endangered species, and in each book, solves a mystery focused around real-world wildlife crimes. While her most recent book, Winged Obsession, is Jessica's first non-fiction book, it reads just like her thrillers. When we spoke, I asked Jessica how she first started writing about wildlife crime.
It was a very unusual transition, Laurel. I had been an actress for many years, and I was working in New York, and I had a recurring day player role on a soap opera. And I ended up getting killed off on the soap opera, unfortunately. And everything was going on at the same time. I'd broken up with a boyfriend, and I thought, you know, I really need to just make a big change. I need to do something else with my life. I want to go far, far away, someplace I've never been. And I took all my money, and I went to Africa. I went to Kenya and Tanzania, and it was during a time that a lot of stuff, not like it's not still going on, but was going on in Africa where elephants were being killed for their ivory and rhino for their horn and all this habitat destruction. And I've always loved wildlife. But I came back all fired up, thinking, what can I do to get involved with wildlife? I'm kind of tired of show business and, you know, having to put on makeup and get dressed up every day and look really good, and the pressure was killing me. And I thought, I really want to do something with wildlife, but I don't want to go back to school. What do I do? What do I do? And I've always been a voracious reader. And I thought, I'm going to write about it. And one night I was watching a show on a news program called 48 Hours with Dan Rather. And he was doing a segment on this woman, Dr. Betsy Dresser, with the Cincinnati Zoo at the time. And she was doing all this research into frozen embryo transfer with endangered species. You know, taking an egg from a black rhino, implanting it in a white rhino as a host, thinking you can bring about a more black rhino this way and help to repopulate the species. And I thought, God, this is such a great idea. I'd love to do a story on this. And I was dating somebody else at the time, who's now my husband, who had said, oh, I am so tired of listening to you moan and groan about what to do with your life. I'll tell you what, I will lend you the money to fly out there and do a story on this woman. And if you sell it, you pay me back. If not, don't worry about it. Do something else. Just do something. And I thought, well, this is a pretty good deal. And I went and tried to do some research on the work she was doing, of which there was nothing. I got a little portable tape recorder, and being an actress and, you know, being used to banging my head against walls and going in for auditions and approaching people, I called this woman up out of the blue, and I basically lied through my teeth. I said, I'm a writer, and I would love to come out and do a story on you. And she was so sweet. She was absolutely wonderful. She said, great, come on out. Yikes. So I had to put questions together and try to think of what I'm doing. And I literally flew out there for one afternoon. I went out, interviewed her with my trusty tape recorder, flew back, and thought, what do I do now? And I wrote up the article, and I thought, what do I do with this now? And George said, well, it's a science piece. Why don't you send it to Omni Magazine? And, you know, the amazing thing is when you're naive about something or you're stupid about something, you have absolutely no fear, and therefore you break all the rules because you don't know any better. I sent it to Omni Magazine, and they bought it. I'd never written anything in my life. I'd never taken a writing course. I was just a real voracious reader. And I thought, oh, my God, this is great. This is easier than auditioning. I'm going to watch more TV. And I did. I watched the Today Show, and they had a segment about the first forensics lab for endangered species in the world with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Ashland, Oregon. And I thought, okay, I'm going to be smart this time. I called up, and I asked them to send me information about the lab, and I wrote up a little one-page piece query. And I sent it to the same editor at Omni who had bought my first story called The Frozen Zoo. And she called me up and she said, oh, we're going to send you out there. We'll pay all your expenses. We'll pay for the article. I went, oh, my God. She sent me out there. I met all these scientists. I'm not a science writer. I don't have a science background. DNA, what's DNA? Serology? Ah! I threw myself on the mercy of the director of the lab, Ken Goddard, who is the most amazing person in the world, who also writes thrillers, and he basically took me under his wing and explained everything to me in layman's terms. And he said, you know, you're so interested in wildlife and what's going on, you should be writing about special agents with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because nobody knows who these guys are. And he said, but whatever you do, do not contact this one agent down in New Orleans. He's a loose cannon. You will regret it the rest of your life. So I immediately flew home, and I contacted that agent because I figured Ken was trying to hide a good story from me. And this was an agent who had done the first really undercover sting operations for Fish and Wildlife and broken the back of the illegal alligator skin trade. And I went down there and spent 2 weeks with him in the bayou meeting every poacher in the world who had gone flipped from poaching, illegally poaching alligators, to now being legitimate multimillionaire businessmen because, you know, alligator skins are now legal. You get permits for them. And they had all their contacts in place. And I saw all this stuff going on. I saw bayou justice where you get caught with illegal wildlife, you get a slap on the wrist, you're back out there again doing it. I kept working for years and years and years, oh my God, years and years, for about 9 years on stories on Fish and Wildlife agents, undercover operations, really, really believing incredibly in what these guys do because they're our thin green line that protect our natural resources, doing everything I could to bring attention to their cause. But I kept thinking about what I had seen in Louisiana. And since then, and learning about how these guys, these agents are so underfunded, undermanned, don't really get support from their own agency. And I sat down one day, I was so frustrated by what I saw going on, that I sat down one day and I started writing my first fiction book in the Rachel Porter Mystery Series about a former New York actress who sort of gets fired from her job, becomes an agent, applies to become an agent, and sort of is this kick-ass New Yorker who breaks the rules because she wants to see justice done. And that's how the Rachel Porter Mystery Series came about.
How interesting. And what was your first book? Rachel do first?
My first book was Gatorade. And she was, as a rookie agent, she was signed down to New Orleans, to Louisiana, dealing with this wild man who was her boss, who broke all the rules, who was considered a loose cannon, and she had to work for him, and it made her absolutely insane. And it was about drug shipments, illegal drug shipments coming in, hidden inside alligator, barrels of alligator skins. And I got that idea because I'd done a story for New York Times magazine on drugs being snuck into the country in wildlife shipments. And I just thought, that's perfect. And I just did sort of a Law and Order twist on a lot of the stuff and a lot of the people that I had met down in that area. And then from there, it was with each book, there are 10 books in the series, I would get an idea of a species I wanted to write about and a certain area of the country. And Rachel would get bounced from area to area because she always got in trouble, was always taking waves. And they were always trying to, you know, bury her in some station somewhere. And it was just, you know, my stories were very much, I would go and work with agents for each book, just like I did for magazine articles. I'd call them up and say, can I come and hang out with you? And they were always wonderful. They'd say, absolutely. Because they knew I was really on their side and trying to help wildlife and that I believed in what they were doing. And so each book I would go, the next one I did was called Tortoise Soup. And it had to do with a magazine assignment I had done when I got the book contract on desert tortoise and habitat conservation plans. But it also tied into development in Las Vegas and to the illegal disposal of high-level nuclear waste. And that came about with my doing a magazine assignment out there on a desert tortoise habitat plan and what was going on with Yucca Mountain and disposal of nuclear rods. So this is how I got ideas for each book. Each book takes place in a different part of the country. The next one had to do with the illegal parrot trade and, you know, the big black hole of stuff coming into the port of Miami. You think about how many wildlife inspectors there are, how many wildlife shipments come in, and it's like finding a needle in a haystack. And I knew about the trouble in Miami only because, once again, lack of manpower. And I tied that in with illegal gun running. So each thing would have something to do that was based on reality. And I would go and interview people who were dealing in parrots in Florida that I was given access to and hear stories and just come back and do this Law and Order twist on everything. And my whole idea was I didn't want to preach to people about wildlife. I'm an actress. I love characters. And a lot of times when I go to interview or research, I think I have a neon sign over my head that says, crazy characters over here, and they come. And the thing is, I'm fascinated by them, and I love listening to them, and I love their stories, and I'm just enthralled, and I really get a kick out of these people in a really weird way. So, you know, this is how I do my research. I have a great time. And with each book, I have insane research stories.
Well, I'm going to ask you about them.
All right. I'll give you a good example of how I research for a book.
Yeah.
This will really say all there is to say. When I decided to do that parrot book, I first had done, I knew about this guy with a wildlife refuge, law enforcement guy, he's a specialist with reptiles. He's an herpologist. And I had heard about him, and he's like the tattooed man. He's like 6'4", and he's got this crew cut, and he's covered head to toe with tattoos, and he looks like a biker, outlaw, and I wanted to meet him. But he's a law enforcement guy, so I went down there to meet him and hung out, and this was over near Immokalee, up near Naples on the West Coast. I went there first, and while I was hanging out with him, I started meeting all these people who own mountain lions, because you can own anything you want in Florida as long as it has been captive bred. You can own Siberian tigers, anything you want. The loophole is captive bred. So I was meeting all these people with mountain lions in pens in their backyard, and I had gone to meet one woman on Immokalee, and somebody who helped her said, she lived in Naples. She said, would you like to come and see my mountain lions? And I went, sure. So I go to her house, and we go in the backyard, and there's a big pen with two mountain lions in it sitting on perches on opposite ends of the cage. She goes, would you like to go in with the mountain lions? I swear to God, I have written nonfiction articles. I'm insane, I admit it. I have written nonfiction articles about mountain lion attacks. I've interviewed people. I know what you do and what you do not do. You do not get in a cage with mountain lions. So I went, sure, because how many chances do you have to go into a cage with a mountain lion? This is incredible. So she hands me a little wooden rake and opens the door, lets me in. She
What's the rake for? Is
in.
That to protect
That's
you?
That's for the toothpick after they're done with me.
Oh.
She closes the door. She doesn't come in with me. And I suddenly realize, you idiot. Both mountain lions are like looking at each other going, lunch has just been provided. They jump off and they start to circle around, each from an opposite side of the cage. And I realize if I turn around and run, I'm dead meat. And I'm backing up with this stupid little wooden toothpick, you know, going, open the door, open the door, open the door. She finally opens the door and lets me out. And that's when you start shaking and you realize how crazy you've been. I go to my hotel that night. I call my husband because I never let him go on my research trips. He would stop my fun. And I tell him all about what I've done that day. And he goes, you idiot, you maniac. Don't ever do anything like that again. He ups the life insurance. And the next day, I get in my little rental car and I start driving across the Everglades, heading towards Miami. This is in July. In July, when you're driving this route, I mean, it's tourist season is dead, and there's not a lot of employment around there, and basically a lot of people work for the Colombian cartels that have fronts for bringing in drugs, and that's the employment. I'm driving across the, I don't even remember what the name of the road is. It cuts through the Everglades, I see
Alligator Alley or something.
Alligator Alley is 95. That's the big main road. This is I have to think of them. I have brain freeze, but I see this little gift shop in the middle of nowhere, that's sort of on stilts, the Florida Panther gift shop, and I stop and go in, and there's a guy in there that has this leather hat on that looks like it's been stomped on, slapped on his head. He's got on these overalls. The eyes are kind of crossed. And, you know, he's just gotten out of jail recently for dealing drugs, and he's working in the gift shop. And we start talking, and I said, you know, I'm really interested in wildlife. And he shows me behind him. He's got this big plaster footprint of skunk ape. Now, skunk ape is Bigfoot's southern cousin. And he's telling me all about skunk ape, and I'm going, that's really, really interesting. I can use this for my book. Then he goes, there's a little bead occurred, and he goes, you want to come see my animals? And I went, sure. We go back through the beta curtain, and there's like this huge plexiglass dome, and there are all these Burmese pythons. And he goes, you want to go in with them? They'd already been fed. Sure. So I go in with all these Burmese pythons, go back that night, tell my husband about it. He's going, you idiot, are you insane? He had just rented the video, Anaconda, the night before, because I won't watch those kinds of movies. They scare me. Are you insane? Are you nuts? Don't ever do that again. Life insurance is going up. Keep going. I land in Miami where I'm going to be working with an agent and where my character, Rachel Porter, is going to be based and is living. And one night I'm walking along a side street. You know, I'm going out to get dinner. And I hear all these birds in these trees. And I'm looking because my book is about parrots. And I'm trying to see what kind of birds they are. And this guy walks up to me with like this little four-year-old boy in tow. And he goes, what are you looking at? And I said, I'm trying to figure out what these birds are. He says, my wife knows all about birds. Honey! And this little woman comes running over in spike high heels, spiky blonde hair, little halter top with like Dolly Parton build, micro mini skirt. And she goes, I just love birds. Would you like to come home and see my cockatoo? So I said, sure. The husband goes out to get something with the boy. I go home with her on Collins Avenue. We go up this walk up in her apartment building. She shows me her cockatoo, shows me that it's toilet trained. We're talking. She pulls out some tequila. We start doing tequila shooters. She tells me she's a stripper, turns around, lifts up her miniskirt. She's got on this little thong underwear, shows me her tattoo. She's going to tell me all about the strip scene. I'm thinking, I can use this for my book. I now have Burmese pythons I can use. I have mountain lions. I've got skunk ape. I got a stripper. I go home that night, call my husband, tell him about this. I go, oh, and the best part is her husband just got out of jail, and he shared a cell with a very big drug dealer that I wrote about in one of my articles. Small world. So I'm telling my husband all about this, and I say, I don't know, she wants to take me to strip clubs. What do you think? And there's a long pause, and he goes, sounds good. So this is the way I do my research for my book, girl.
So it's not a lot of...
It's a lot of on-the-ground research, you know, and then I go out with the agents, and I meet lots of experts, but I sort of throw everything into the pot, and I spend a lot of time doing research.
And now for your new book, which is your first nonfiction book, called Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler, what prompted you to... both turn to nonfiction and also, you know, what attracted you to this story?
You know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. In fact, a lot of times. And when this case first broke with Yoichi Kojima, who is the butterfly smuggler, a friend of mine who's a wildlife agent called and he said, there's this amazing case, really twisted, crazy case. And I started following it, and I knew that Kojima was sent to prison here in the U.S. And I thought, this story is so unbelievable, this undercover operation that took place over 3 years. And the agent who was in charge of it was a rookie agent, had been handed this case because they really didn't think it was going anywhere. This smuggler had been working in the U.S. and around the world and hadn't been caught. He just was so clever. So amazing, so good at what he did. And they thought, oh, we're going to let this rookie agent just cut his teeth on this and go and keep an eye on this guy. He was selling at the Bug Fair, which is in Los Angeles every year. Let him go and just watch him and see what happens. And he actually went over to Yoichi in his undercover persona and started a conversation at the fair. Yoichi befriended him, and boom, the case was on. It was just so amazing, everything that happened. It was better than any novel I'd ever heard of. And I became obsessed with the idea of doing this story. I think I became as obsessed with Yoichi Kojima and this case as Yoichi was with butterflies. And I knew I had to do this book. And I was working on other things, and when I finally got around to it, I put a proposal together. A publisher was interested. They bought the book. By the time all of this had happened, Yoshi was out of jail, and he was a felon, so he'd been sent back to Japan. Can't come back to this country. But I knew that a lot of people had tried, a lot of journalists had tried to get to Yoshi, and he refused to speak to anyone. I spent a lot of time with the undercover agent and interviewing a lot of people who knew Yoshi, who were over in this country. I did all my research. I was able to read case reports. I was able to see undercover Skype tapes. I learned everything I could about Yoshi inside out. I interviewed the prosecuting attorney. I called Yoshi's attorney, who refused to speak to me, refused to say anything. He just said, well, why don't you go meet Mr. Kojima himself, ha, 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 and hung up on me. And I thought, good idea.
It seems like whenever...
Yeah, there you go. Good idea.
I'll think of an idea for you and see what happens. No, I'm just kidding.
But I mean, I knew I couldn't, call up Kojima or contact him and say, hey, I'm a writer. I'm going to come over to Japan and meet you, because he refused to speak to anyone. I had everything. I had this entire case. I had spent so much time on it. As I said, I interviewed people, everyone who knew Yoshi over here, anybody I could get to, anyone that would talk to me. But I felt, in order to do this story justice, do this book justice, and because I had become so crazy about it, I had to meet Kojima. I had to meet him. And I didn't know if he would be alive, if he would be dead, if he would be in Japan, because he always traveled the world collecting butterflies, was rarely around. I knew nothing. I did know his last address. And I just went, I flew to Japan, cold, and made my way to Kyoto, where he is, and tracked down his place, and went undercover, and was able, through various means, to bump into him, so to speak. And over the course of...
And what was he like? Did he compare to what you thought?
It's always hard because you're getting somebody else's opinion of this guy. And I had the undercover agent's opinion. And I found Yoshi to be an incredibly charming man. He was very nice to me. And that put me in a real dilemma. Because I thought, here's this guy who is basically... Nobody really had befriended me in Japan. Very few people spoke English. I knew Yoshi spoke English. Here was a guy that didn't know me from a hole in the wall and befriended me. I spent a lot of time with him in a very short period. We spent a lot of very intense time together and went out for, lunch and coffee and dinner and hours and hours and hours and hours that we spoke. And I thought, oh my God, how can I do this to this guy? And I was really totally guilt-ridden about it. And we had dinner the last night I was there. And we were talking, and out of the blue, Yoshi suddenly says to me, I wish I could use eBay. I would love to sell on eBay. I don't know how to use eBay. Do you know how to use eBay? Now, Yoshi is on a lot of auction sites, just like eBay in Japan. And he had used the same line on Ed Newcomer.
Who's the rookie agent?
And the idea was he was looking for his next patsy who would take the fall. We couldn't be in the United States, which didn't matter for eBay. But if anybody were to be caught, he needs a cover, somebody who's handling this for him. The undercover agent was taking that role on here before, Yoshi was caught. And I was to be the next patsy. And when he said that, it's like you go... Two things happen at once. You go, you feel betrayed. I mean, here I was going to betray him, and we were both using each other, and I suddenly realized what was happening. And at the same time, I felt relieved. And then I came home, and here's what's not in the book. You get a big coup here. This is not in the book. I maintained contact with Yoshi when I came home. We Skyped quite a bit. And he would talk for an hour, 2 hours, until I'd have to say, gotta go, Yoshi, gotta go. So I got to know him even more. And what happened is he started saying, oh, you know, there's some butterflies I really want to buy, but the dealers over here, I want to buy in the United States, but the dealers are so scared to sell to me. It's so silly. It's so silly. They won't get caught. They should just send international mail. It's so silly. And beautiful butterflies. I have an idea. You buy them for me on PayPal. You contact these dealers. I'll tell you what to get. You buy them for me, and I'll pay you back on PayPal, and you mail them to me. And he kept pushing, because it was getting closer to butterfly season when these butterflies were going to be available. And I realized I had to cut contact. I had to end all communication because I wasn't about to do that. What he was asking me to do was totally illegal. And one butterfly in particular that he wanted is considered vulnerable and is a butterfly of concern here in the States. And he didn't tell me that. I looked it up. And I just went, oh, boy. And I talked to a few agents and told them what was going on. And they said, yeah, time to end this. And I did. That's when I fully ended all communication with him. And I don't even have that in the book because I didn't want to bring... I wanted to end it in Japan with my trip. But, you know, that's what was happening with Yoshi. Yoshi is still in business. He's never going to stop.
Now, he was, in the end, busted after 3 years. And really, I mean, it's 3 years with Ed Newcomer, but it's a lot of years before that with other agents who couldn't
catch him.
And I have to say, the book is a great read if you're interested in, you know, just taking yourself inside a case from beginning to end. And wanted to just have you give a little synopsis of the butterfly trade. How big is the butterfly trade, and why do people even want them?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Once again, it's impossible to know how big the illegal trade is because it's just like drugs. Nobody keeps numbers. I have heard it's a $200 million illegal business a year, but nobody knows. I mean, you know, that's best guess estimates. It's huge. I mean, there are a lot of people want to collect whatever is rare, and there are a lot of butterflies that are becoming more and more rare, and they're beautiful. They're beautiful. I mean, but what do you do with these things? You mount them, you stick them in a drawer. You can't have them out with sunlight or they will fade. But it's a big business. I mean, you think of most people I know love to collect something. I collect masks. I collect stuffed animals. I mean, everybody gets into these things and you want another one. And oh my God, wouldn't that be great for my collection? It's the same with wildlife. And there are a lot of these guys out there that are obsessed with getting a list of what's not on that list. And the more difficult it is to get, the more they want it. It's rare. Yeah, it's endangered. But, hey, I need that for my collection. So it's a big, big trade. And a lot of the guys out there, I mean, when you go to the bug fair, and there are bug fairs around the world, but I know the one that's coming up in L.A. in May 14th and 15th this year, is the 25th anniversary of this particular bug fair, where people go and buy bugs and butterflies. In one weekend, there are 14,000 people that attend this. And this is not the biggest butterfly fair in the world. So you figure, what is going on out there? It's unbelievable. I can tell you how big it is. Bugs are a national obsession in Japan. There is a documentary out called The Beetle Queen of Tokyo, which is wonderful. It was actually made by somebody who works part-time at the Museum of Natural History in New York. And it shows there's one dealer who actually is riding around in a Jaguar and living this great life, and he makes his money off selling bugs. It's a big business. I had heard that Kojima sold one beetle, Dynasties Hercules. It was the biggest of its kind in, oh my God, where was it? It might have been in Ecuador. And he called, or he found somebody who was interested, a Japanese, who was interested in buying the live bug because the idea is to breed it, and who flew over to Ecuador and paid him $100,000 for this bug and flew back with the bug. It's a big business.
So in part, for some of the beetles and other bugs, other insects, it's for pets. essentially.
It's for pets, essentially, and they have a lot of clubs in Japan where they will try to breed who can be breed the biggest bug. It's pets, and it's also clubs, like you have auto clubs here, or you know, any of these things. You know, people are flying their birds, and they're showing off their birds, their pigeons. It's all this type of thing. I mean, Mike Tyson has a show right now on Animal Planet, you know, about flying his pigeons. It's the same thing with clubs with bugs. They show off their bugs. Little kids in Japan will go into the forests, and they'll get these beetles that are native to the area, and they'll have contests where they'll have their beetles fight each other. You know, it's like wrestling or something. And this is, you know, they have a reverence, a reverence for bugs in nature in this sense. People keep in Japan keep crickets in their home because they love the sound. It's this whole deep tie, deep rooted tie to nature. It's just a different way that they view it, and it's really fascinating.
Kojima, he was selling beetles as well as butterflies?
He was selling everything, right? Yeah, I think he still has bugs. When I was at his place, I saw scarab beetles that were dead, that were gorgeous, like jewels that he showed me. So he deals in whatever he can. I don't think he travels anymore, but he's got people everywhere who send things to him that he buys from. He's got contacts everywhere in the world that he deals with. But yeah, he deals in bugs and butterflies. I mean, he's
like a bug mogul.
He is. He's a very, very smart, very intelligent man. He got his degree in entomology at the University of Osaka. And from what he told me, his father was a very well-known lepidopterist. He learned everything from his father. He's a very smart guy.
So for butterflies, it's not for pets because it's always dead and mounted. And
they're dead because you want perfect, perfect butterflies. The way to get a perfect butterfly without a scratch, without a tear, you don't want that, or it's not good for your collection. The way you do it is to kill them very shortly after they're born. You know, there's no other way to get a perfect specimen. You don't pick up dead butterflies off the ground, no matter what anybody tells you, and have a perfect specimen. Doesn't happen. You have to kill them.
How does that work? So you need to basically hatch them, or
you need to do need to hatch them. They will collect the eggs out in the wild, and they will have these. It's almost like a shade, closed-in shade that they will have once they've been feeding the caterpillars. They feed them. They have to have the right plants to feed them, and then when they're in that final phase and they're going to hatch, they'll put them in a hatching net, and they can actually watch to see when they hatch. When they hatch, and the wings are out, they will take them. They will put them in, like what I know one collector did, one breeder. He would stick them in cellophane envelopes with the wings open. He would stick them in his refrigerator. Let the wings harden, because you want them to harden so that they don't get stained by any of the fluid or grease that comes out. You let the wings harden, and once the wings are fairly hardened, you take the cellophane envelope, you put the butterflies in your freezer, and that kills them.
You, as part of your research, you also had to learn how to mount them.
I didn't have to learn. I wanted to try. I was working with a lepidopterist from University of Riverside by the name of Dr. Gordon Pratt, and he was wonderful, who took me out to the field and told me a lot about butterflies. I was working with him and another man, Dr. John Emmel, who's very famous in the field, and they were wonderful. They taught me a lot of information. Gordon showed me how to mount, let me try, even though I was pretty unsuccessful and pretty well massacred butterflies and just said, I can't do this anymore. It's a real skill. It's really amazing.
So it's like an art. It's essentially like an art form, almost.
It's a total art form, and this is one thing that Kojima was very famous for. There are a lot of butterflies that are not mounted well. If you're a collector, you want, and you're going to buy a mounted butterfly, you can buy them unmounted. And when you buy them, over the internet from like Kojima or whatever, you get them unmounted so that they're folded. And then you can mount them. Because if he sends them mounted overseas, they could easily break. So you have to be very careful. When you go into a store, you buy them mounted. Or if you buy them here and they're in frames, that's fine. But he doesn't frame them. So unless they're framed, you don't want to buy just a mounted, but, you know, the wings spread. There's nothing to protect them, and it can break.
Oh, so for transport, you're actually better off with unmounted.
Unless you're buying them framed. Yeah, totally framed and within glass, and then they're protected. So but he was very well known for his mounting. He is a true craftsman.
And so what is the process for mounting a butterfly?
I don't know the whole process, but you do put them on these boards, and the board has a ridge down the middle, so that's where the thorax, the body, the legs go. You spread, carefully spread the wings, and you put a little tape across them, and then you pin them. You can pin them onto a little styrofoam thing to keep the wings perfect.
And so the wings are supported? They're supported by the board.
They're supported so you
them?
Can spread. Yeah, so you can spread it and pin them. You always see them pinned. Well, you don't pin the wings. You pin the thorax on a little piece of pegboard or whatever underneath. I don't have the. Somebody's going to massacre me on this because I don't have the proper knowledge on this. You tape the wings very lightly. You put a little thing where the tape isn't going to hurt the wings, but put a pin through the thorax to hold it in place.
And then how do you spread out the wings? It would seem like that's where it would tear.
Very carefully. Obviously, I didn't do it well. Very carefully. Yeah, it's. I was not well trained. I mean, I did, about an hour of that. I really didn't put my attention on that because that wasn't where my interest lay so much.
Right.
But it is an art.
Now, what are the biggest species in the trade? In your book, Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler, you talk about the big four.
Well, there's the not even size-wise as far as the rarity of them. Mm-hmm. It's like the Grand Slam, the Big Four. But the biggest bird wing is one of those, and that's the Queen Alexandra, which is from Papua New Guinea and is just a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous butterfly. And that's an incredibly endangered butterfly and also a very desired butterfly. So that's one of them. Another one is the Homerus, which is from Jamaica. From one area in Jamaica. So that also is highly endangered, and that's a national symbol of Jamaica. It's one of their monetary bills. I don't remember what denomination, but it's on there. Another one is called the Hospiton, which is a small butterfly and not a big flashy butterfly, but it's once again very rare, and that's from Sardinia in Italy. And then the last one is the Chikai, which is a beautiful butterfly, and that's from the Philippines. And that's also a bird wing.
And what makes a bird wing a bird wing? Why do they call them bird wings?
A bird wing is because
meaning a bird wing
so
butterfly
large.
Versus a
they're
wing
so
bird.
Large. I mean, the Queen Alexandra can have a wingspan of up to a foot wide.
Up
that's
to a foot.
That's a big butterfly. So they call them bird wings because they're like the size of small birds. They're not like teeny-weeny butterflies. These are larger butterflies.
And then in the U.S., are there certain species that are really desired here in the U.S.?
The
U.S.?
One of the species that is very desired, a particular type, is the Indra. One is Indra kybobensis, I think is the right pronunciation. But they are, for some reason... collectors love this butterfly.
And where's
and
it
a
from?
Lot of them are in, well, they're inside and outside the Grand Canyon. And, of course, you're not allowed to collect them inside the Grand Canyon. I mean, they're also, they can be around Santa Clarita, northern Los Angeles. But they're protected inside the Grand Canyon area. That's, of course, where everybody wants them.
Why? Are they
the
better
particular,
there?
Because it's a particular subspecies, and they're protected. If it's protected, it means you're not allowed to have them, which means nobody else has got them, so you want them.
So basically
there's a scarcity of legal specimens. there's a scarcity of this particular specimen. And they turn up on the black market all the time, and I know that Yoshi dealt in them, and I think still does deal in them. He is somebody who goes and collects the eggs in Grand Canyon National Park.
Now, who is doing the trade, and, you know, where's it going from and to? It sounds like all over.
Japan is huge for butterflies.
For
Germany
purchasing
is huge
butterflies.
Japan for purchasing. Okay. Japanese love butterflies. Big, big market. Germany is a big, big market. And the United States is a big market.
And
I mean, there is a big bug fair that takes place every year in Italy, another in Germany, another in Japan. And the one in Japan is supposed to be unbelievable.
When you say a bug fair, what happens? Traders come and, you know, can you describe one of these bug fairs? I know you mentioned
the... I can describe the one I went to at the Los Angeles Museum of Natural History. And that is the entire bottom floor of the museum, both the main entrance hall and both wings, you know, the both giant wings halls, North American mammals and all, it is filled. You'll have maybe booths with 80 different vendors offering an array of bugs, of butterflies, anything that you can think of with the trade. And you get people in there. You'll get other dealers, you'll get traders, you'll get collectors, you'll get kids who are interested in this. Everybody, it's amazing the people that have an interest in this. When I was there 2 years ago, I saw celebrities with their kids walking around the fair and buying, you know, pretty bugs and butterflies. And it's a way to teach kids about things. So obviously a lot of kids are there. But collectors come with their boxes to put the butterflies in, to protect them. They're wooden boxes. And you know, these are the real collectors. These are the guys. And they go around from vendor to vendor to see unusual butterflies.
And a lot of it
they need for their collection.
And a lot of it is perfectly legal.
It is at the museum, it is supposed to be perfectly legal. What has gone on in the past, that of course they don't want to have it go on and they try to stop, is Yoshi always brought illegal stuff, black market stuff, and it would be under the table. And when he knew that somebody might be interested, he'd say, come over here. And he'd show them something. He'd say, look what I have.
Is the trade affecting butterfly populations?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, habitat destruction, obviously, is the number one effector of butterfly populations, right? If they don't have the habitat is being destroyed. That's a big problem. So when they're already vulnerable, then you have poachers out there these butterflies are already hard hit, and then the poachers come in, they're pushing them over the edge. So it's not the number one factor is collecting, but it is the number two factor when these butterflies are already vulnerable and are threatened or endangered. It just makes it that much worse. They don't have a chance.
What's that mean in terms of the ecosystem? Why should we care that they're being lost, butterflies are being lost?
What's really interesting is you always get this question, and there's an environmental biologist, and I just love his analogy, a guy from Stanford by the name of Paul Ehrlich, and he always uses the analogy that when we lose a species, think of it as rivets on a plane. One rivet pops, and then another, and then another, and then another. What happens to that plane? The plane eventually goes down. Species are a crucial link. Every species, no matter what it is, it's part of a crucial link to this planet and to life on this planet. You lose one. Big deal. You use another, 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 another. What eventually happens to this planet? It's the same sort of thing. We're going to be affected. Eventually, the top of the chain, the top of the food chain, us, we're going to be affected. So that's the analogy I like to use best, because somehow it gives a visual for people to latch onto and to think, maybe there is something to that.
Now, one of the things I found really interesting, switching back to the book Winged Obsession, was that it's really a story of ups and downs of doing an investigation and of an obsession. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about, you know, is that typical? Is that type of ups and downs?
In a case?
In a case. Just
Well, it's really interesting to me. I mean, this, again, is an old analogy, but when I first started working with agents, one of the things I learned is that a lot of cases, they always think they're going to trip across, it's going to be an easy case. Oh, yeah, something's been poached. Easy case. And many times, the more they get into it, it's like peeling that proverbial onion, where there's another layer, and then another, and another, and another, because so many of these guys, not in Yoshi's case, but so many of these guys, same guys who deal in drug smuggling, gun running, money laundering, also deal in illegal wildlife. Because you get caught with that, it's a slap on the wrist. And, you know, why not smuggle everything? It's another commodity, and there's money to be made. So a lot of times, a case turns into much more than you thought it was going to be, and it ends up encompassing a lot of different federal agencies, not just Fish and Wildlife. I mean, there are cases that involve the IRS has been brought in. Of course, DEA, you know, ATF, all these different agencies somehow will all end up working on a case together because it becomes a very complex case. So this is the interesting thing about these cases. And the up and downs with this case were very interesting. And I think a lot of it, I think Ed Newcomer, the undercover agent, is a wonderful, fantastic agent. He's amazing with undercover work. But he was still a rookie when he started this case. And I think even he will admit there are some things he could have done differently, handled a little differently, because this case this case fell apart twice. And he was very lucky it was resurrected once more. And everything came together that third time. It's really interesting. He just couldn't put this case to bed.
And why not? How did it get under his skin?
You know, one of the things is that Kojima had made so much fun. He would make fun of the first wildlife agent, undercover agent, John Mendoza, who was after him. And he would go, oh, he thought he was so smart and that, you know, stupid guy, and I outfoxed him. And you don't say that to another wildlife agent. They get it's a challenge then. It's a challenge to get your target, to get your prey. This is a guy that was really sort of a wrecking ball when it came to our environment. He was out there. I mean, other collectors have told me about stuff that he did when he was out collecting, how he just was a collecting hog, as they called him. They were upset because they felt that he was hurting their chances to go out and collect things because he would overcollect. He was like a vacuum cleaner. And it's an obsession that these people get. And I know Yoshi loves bugs and he loves insects. I mean, he truly does. But he thinks of them in a different sense, as he's saying, oh, isn't this beautiful, and kills it. I mean, he told me a story about how all the other little boys in Japan when he was growing up would go and collect bugs like I told you about and play with them. He would go and collect bugs and kill them for his collection, even as a little boy. He loved them, but he loved them dead. He loved them as part of his collection. But he also knows everything about them. So it's just a different way what you put your value on and how you look at wildlife. His way of looking at it is it's incredibly expendable, and he wants it.
Did he make a lot of money for it?
He says he did. I don't know. He says he did. It's you know, this is, how do you know? How do you know? He says he did. But he told me a lot of stories, and one of the things about Yoshi that I knew before I went over there, because I had done so much homework on him. I knew him as inside out as you possibly could. I knew him as well as the Fish and Wildlife agent did. And I knew that Yoshi is a habitual liar. He's come to believe a lot of the stories over the years that aren't true, that he's made up. You know, you say them enough and they become real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Yoshi. So I would hear all these crazy stories about all the real estate he had owned and had, you know, a place in Trump Towers. And, you know, I knew half of this wasn't true. You know, kind of what's true. I mean, there may be things that were true that I didn't know. You take everything with a grain of salt. So he would tell me how much money he had made
Which was a lot, like $360,000 to $600,000 a
year.
Yeah,
he would go on how much he made every year, how much he made every week. And yet, when I went over and met him, and I went into his, he has the family brownstone of sorts building in Kyoto that he lives in. And the bottom floor used to be, he used to have an antique shop that's now closed. But it's a cement floor, concrete floor, and you walk in there and there's this horrible stench. And it's because the sewer is backed up. And he's in a fight with his brother, who he said used to be at his place every night, who I never met, and I was there in the evenings. I never saw any sign of his brother. Who knows? He and his brother were in a fight as to who was going to pay to fix this. Now, if he had that much money, this place was a mess. So it wasn't like he was, you know, living high on the hog, so to speak. We'll never know. That's what makes him so intriguing.
Well, if people are interested in butterflies or learning more, what would you recommend that they do?
If they're really interested in butterflies, I mean, I would join. There are a lot of local butterfly clubs where they don't even collect. They go out and watch. North American Butterfly Association, NABA is a good association. There's the Xerces Society for Butterflies. There's lots of places to gain information on butterflies. You know, wonderful field books. Some of these butterfly clubs, a lot of people in there are lepidopterists, entomologists, have great backgrounds, lots of information. They know way more practical stuff about butterflies than me. I just know Yoshi's story, and that's what fascinated me. That is what fascinated me. And then getting into, once you do that, I was getting into some of the legends and the lore and some of the more dramatic mating habits of certain species, and that stuff interests me. But there's a lot of information out there for people.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, I love it, Laurel. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about trafficking butterflies with Jessica Spirit, author of Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.